Amen.
Okay. And as most of you know, that we've been doing a workshop with Peter M. and Chris S. For the last couple of months. And tonight is the last night. And what they're going to hopefully do is kind of a wrap-up of the process of their experience. And then we can open up for some Q&A. And that's it. So I'll turn the meeting over to Peter M. and Chris S.
Thanks, Dave. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I've really enjoyed the last couple of months here with you all, and especially with Peter. I get a lot out of his shared experience. You probably, if you've been to enough of these meetings, you probably know that our philosophy is really very, very similar as far as the importance we give to the recovery process in Alcoholics Anonymous. For many, many years in the Northeast, and I don't really know why, the recovery process was kind of lost in the fellowshipping of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to the detriment, I think, of all of our spiritual conditions. And there's kind of a renaissance that's been going on lately that's helping to turn the tide a little bit back. And there's like little pockets of enthusiasm that are opening up where people are sharing and experiencing the recovery process. Peter's got a group in Union, and we have the Burnsville group. There's groups all over the place now, and I'm very, very grateful for that. There's an ask it basket in the back. Some of the people that came in have asked some questions. After we're done sharing, we'll get to that. And if the questions run out, we've got a microphone that Bill has set up here. Anybody that wants to share anything or ask us any questions. I certainly don't pretend to be an expert in Alcoholics Anonymous or an authority or anything like that. Anytime I share my experience, it's just basically what I've learned going through the process myself, what I've learned working with others, and the philosophy that surrounds that experience. So I'm not going to tell you right, wrong, or indifferent. It really just is my experience. Peter, what do you got?
Not much. I'm Peter. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober and had an AA meeting. God separated me from alcohol June 23rd, 1988. Very grateful to be a recovered alcoholic. My home group is a Vision for You group in Union, New Jersey. We meet Thursday nights at 7:30 to 8:45. And I've shared this a million times. Most people in Union don't like my group because we talk about a solution until they bottom out, and then they come to look for my group. And when they're really desperate, they ask me to sponsor them. But I feel really grateful to be a part of that group and do some service while I'm there and carry a message to an alcoholic. Whether they're here for the first meeting right out of treatment, right out of detox, or they're in AA for a long time, running around in AA untreated, wondering how come it's caving in on them wherever they go. So I stand at the door ready, like most members in my home group, and I'm grateful to be a part of that. It's been a real neat deal here for me to come back again and share with Chris. We did something similar up in Vermont, and always have a lot of fun with this stuff. One of the questions that I would get after the hour was up, and one of the questions I get very often when my phone rings goes something like, my home group hates me because I'm talking about the big book. Or my network of groups, the groups I go to in my area, no one's talking about the 12 steps, and I'm fed up with AA, I can't take it anymore. Whenever I go speak, how come people walk out on me when I share? And this is some of the questions I would get, what to do, what to do, what to do. And I only share my experience if that's happening to you. I pay no attention to that. God has given me a solution, and my job is to live it and go share it. And I was thinking of that while Chris was talking, and there's a little piece in here, in a vision for you. It says, thus we grow and so can you, though you be but one man or woman with this book in your hand, we believe and hope it contains all you will need to begin. We know what you are thinking. You say to yourself, I'm jittery and alone. I couldn't do that. But you can. You forget that you have just now tapped a source of power much greater than yourself. To duplicate with such backing what we have accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. And when I moved out to Union, I think I was banned from half the meetings in Union. They weren't too thrilled about seeing me. But I kept, you know, suiting up and showing up, and I took this into prayer. And I got silent, waiting for an answer. And what came to me was, maybe you need to start a group. And I wasn't sure if that was ego or that was really God. And I ran it by my sponsor. I sought counsel with that, and hung a shade, got a couple of guys together, put a format together, which we borrowed from a group called the Way Out Group in Staten Island. And we're a little over 2 years old, and the lights are on, the coffee's going, and we're talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I even share that with some people. Maybe you need to take some responsibility and start your own little group about a solution to alcoholism. So I guess I kick it back to Chris, and we'll see where we go tonight.
I was at a meeting on Sunday night, and I was talking with a really good friend of mine. Does workshops with us every once in a while. He's very, very active in taking people through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And down in his area, he's been told not to come back to certain groups, which I think is that's a flagrant violation of our traditions. But these groups are, really don't care much for him. And he continues to go to those groups, and he even doesn't share, and they still ask him to leave. Because can you imagine? He doesn't say a word in the meeting, and they still want him out. Because what he does is, after the meeting, if there's anybody that's hurting, he goes up and he makes himself available for taking them through the steps. And for some crazy reason, this is looked upon as heretical AA or something, when really it's AA at its most basic. In the first 10 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was all about taking people through the 12 steps and then kind of allowing them to be part of the fellowship. And today it's kind of in reverse. You really come in and you get initiated by just having a seat and, you know, sharing or whatever. And then if you're lucky, you'll find a good sponsor who will drag you kicking and screaming through the steps. Because the steps prior to investigation, we just inherently balk at them. I was running with a really good friend of mine on Sunday, and I want to tell this story because it was so profound for me. I can't get enough testimony to the fact that this process works. We're running. Now, this individual, his father was a raging alcoholic, left the family at a very young age, would pull things like coming home at like drunk midnight on Christmas. The family hasn't seen him in 3 years, and the mother would like call the police, and the presents are out on the sidewalk. And I mean, just real, real family of origin alcoholic issues, just screaming. And many of us have experienced those kind of things. And he's talking to me about this, and he says, you know, because I had a resentment against my mother for all this stuff. And I was terrible growing up, but I could not get over this. And he goes, I got into therapy, and I did the wounded inner child thing. And I spent tons of money and tons of time and just exploring all these things. And what I got out of his talk was he learned a great deal about why he was in pain. And he could talk very, very eloquently about why he has certain emotional problems. He was very, very educated about his pain. But it never got any better. And then he got involved with Howard, actually, over in Berkeley Heights, who took him kicking and screaming through the steps. And when it comes to the ninth step, he was instructed to list everything that he had done, every way he had fallen short that he was clear on in the relationship of being a good son. He went to his mother, he laid all this stuff out, and from that moment on, the resentment was gone, the pain was gone, that crippling emotional bondage that we get stuck in with these deep-seated resentments were gone. Now, why I'm sharing this is for a couple of reasons. One of them is we don't come in to Alcoholics Anonymous with one of those. You know, we come in with a ton. If somebody comes up to me and they've only got like six or eight resentments on their inventory, I'll tell them that's a bad day. That's not an inventory. You know what I mean? We come in with a lot of that stuff, and we're ruined because of it all. And it just seems so simple, doesn't it? I mean, like, write out an inventory, you know, go make an amends. It takes you maybe a couple of days and 4 cents worth of writing material. And he had spent a fortune with professionals trying to get past this stuff. And he got past it working with, you know, a guy from Berkeley Heights who knew how to go through the steps. You know, those stories are additional testimony to me about how this thing works and why what our groups are involved in doing, you know, carrying a very, very conservative recovery-based message is important. It's important. You want to grab some questions now?
Sure.
Dave, do you got the basket? Okay, here we go. The question is, when you want a specific defect removed that's causing you and others harm, and you have tried all of AA's suggestions, yet it seems not to give, what do you do?
A friend of mine talked about going to God in 6 and 7 to remove his arrogance. He knew he was getting people angry, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he says, God, take this arrogance from me. That was about 15 years ago, and he's still arrogant. Through the working of that, he realized that he offers things up, and sometimes we take an asset to the extreme, becomes a liability. But what he had to learn from that, and I'll share my own experience with this, was that some of his arrogance that he was praying to be removed was not what needed to be removed. It was how he had to deliver it to people. Some of his arrogance has been able to help him help many people because they pay attention to him, his prospects, when he talks. He has no problem pulling the covers on someone. He has no problem cutting away the fat and getting right down to causes and conditions in a very arrogant, pompous way. But it's his way of delivering a message that his prospects, and he has many of them, listen to. I've turned to God many, many times and wondering how come this defect is not being removed. And what I had to simply find out was, am I trying to enforce my will upon God? Take this defect from me. Take this defect from me. And I tell my network, hey, I'm praying for this defect to be removed, and it's not being removed. I'm doing inventory on it. It's not being removed. And I finally find out that I'm trying to enforce my will upon God. And the other thing I had to find out was this. I may say that I'm praying to God. I'm turning to God. I'm using God. I'm going to God. God, God, God. And I'm giving God a lot of lip service. But I'm totally agnostic even in that. That I haven't totally surrendered to God, having given up with all, given away any kind of notion that maybe I can control it a little bit. I'm still holding on to some degree. And I've been guilty of that over the years. And I find many people who come to me say, hey, here's my problem, that they're giving God a lot of lip service, but haven't truly surrendered everything to God. Truly surrendered without worrying, meaning not looking at what the outcome's going to look like, how I'm going to be. Am I willing to live life on terms other than my own? So I can say, you know, take this arrogance from me and still hold on because I want to control it a little bit. I'll use arrogance when it's convenient, but I'm not really giving it to God. And if I give God all my arrogance, well, what happens to me then? See, that's agnosticism. I give arrogance to God. I give whatever it may be to God. And where I land, I'm not concerned with. So to answer this question, am I giving God lip service or am I totally surrendering to God? And really being ready to be made new. What kind of action am I taking after I work with 6 and 7, after I turn this defect to God? What kind of action am I taking afterwards? Some of these things I work with a mantra through the day too, throughout my day. Turn in order to go out. Turn into this power in order to go out. Turn, work with the word, turn, watch, aware, observe.
You know, I think a lot like all of us, I think, sometimes I can fool myself to my will. To my level of willingness, and I may not really be as willing. The 12 and 12 talks about being as willing to give up a character defect as we were to overcome alcoholism, having that kind of desperation and that kind of willingness. I don't know that I go into 6 and 7 with that, with a lot of my character defects. And I have prayed for a lot of my character defects to be removed. Some of them have, and some of them still kind of hang on. At least for 15 years now, every single day, twice a day, I've prayed to have my judgmentalism removed. Because especially in the early days of AA, man, I was so judgmental. There was like 96% of you guys I didn't like. And I could tell you exactly what was wrong with you. I could inventory you beautifully, you know, from across the room. And it caused me a lot of pain. And it was really, it's only just kind of begun to get under control. I mean, it doesn't cause me the pain it used to, but I'm still very judgmental. Another thing is, you know, again, like Peter said, how do I know God's not using one of my defects of character? How do I know that God's not using my ego? Because I think it takes a certain type of egotism to do workshops or to speak behind the podium as much as I do. How do I know that that's not working? How do I know that my defect isn't contributing to my being able to channel a recovery message? So I've kind of backed away from being attached to the removal of these things and just try to work more on the humility and the persistent practice of the principles and just see what happens. You know, it really has, you know, God's worked better things in my life than I ever could have if I wrote the script.
One of the things I had a problem with, well, I thought I had a problem with, was, especially growing up, even to adulthood, I try to be like John Wayne, but I would cry watching cartoons. And I had this sensitive part of me, like, come on, toughen up, you know? And I thought it was such a horrible defect for a guy to have, you know, be real sensitive about stuff. Cry at a movie, got to run out and come back like you're acting tough again. And I would go through this drama all the time, right? And I sat with someone, and this gentleman pointed out that you have this thing for people feeling comfortable to talk to you about almost anything, and you being there present with them. And being able to get past their stuff and kind of get in there with them, be very receptive to people. You seem to do that well. He says, is it possible it's because you happen to be maybe a little bit more sensitive than the next person? The byproduct of it is it puts me in awkward situations when I cry when I really don't want to. So what I thought was just awful defect turned out to be a wonderful gift. And I don't look at that as a defect. You know, I am God. Take away the sensitiveness. Make me into Tony Soprano, you know. Inflicting my will upon God.
Okay, here's a Here's a very profound one. Why doesn't the Burnsville Group have a better choice of Danish and cookies? Hey, I will tell you that it wasn't too many years ago that we had like an executive chef who was the coffee maker here. You remember? And he would come in and he would make gourmet soups, and there would be like fruits and, you know, all this like, yeah, where is he? But, you know, we are, you know, we're not really about the Danish and the cookies here. We do. It is Burnsville, though, and we do have high bottom choices of cookies. It's not just you know, Oreos all the time. You have at least a decent assortment. The Danishes, I don't know. We'll have a group conscience meeting after the meeting to talk about the Danish issue. Okay. Are either of you ever inclined to go to contemporary AA, and how do you know when?
We must. We need to be there. We can't always preach to the choir. But we must visit, you know, the sordid spots in AA where they're talking about everything but a solution, everything but alcohol. We need to be there. We need to look for prospects. We need to carry a message. So I visit a lot of those places. And how do I know when I'm there? You know when you're there. But I've been real clear as to not character assassinate someone as to what they're sharing. I'll challenge it, but I won't assassinate someone's character because of what they're sharing, because then I become just as dangerous as the person who tells the real alcoholic just put the plug in the jug. And then what I'm really doing is giving the book lip service and not living it. But you can kind of sense, like I shared this last time I did a workshop here, when you come into this group, you can sense something, a pocket of enthusiasm, and people are talking about a solution. People are interested in what's going on. And when you get to do these, they get to be easy because everyone's very receptive. We're given almost permission to talk like this. And sometimes when you walk into a contemporary AA meeting, it's happened to me many times where you walk into a meeting about this big and they're silent. You don't hear anything. Two people there, three people there, just dazing off, you know, just wondering when the meeting's going to be over. Hey, did you watch the game? You know what that guy said? Oh, there she is again. Then the gavel hits the table. We get spiritual for an hour and then we go home. And you could hear it from the speakers or the sharing from the floor. Everything's talked about but the 12 steps or God or any kind of recovery, growing up spiritually, any kind of 10 and 11 practices. So you kind of know. And so be it. But my job is to not go there and assassinate someone's character, but be there and offer what has been given to me without expectations that I'm going to get a standing ovation when I'm done. Just go share. I sponsor lots of guys, and I get this with the newer guys. I went to this meeting. It was the worst moment of my life. I can't believe it. I'm never going to go back there again. I can't believe it. It was a sad day for me in Alcoholics Anonymous when I went to this meeting. And, you know, how dare you? Go and offer a solution rather than sit back in the back of the room with my arms folded, you know, taking everyone's inventory. And so this one guy, his amends was to go back to that group and share and offer a solution and thank the speaker for sharing regardless of what they shared. So
I have a lot of experience taking people through the steps. And when I first started doing it, there wasn't a lot of people doing what we were doing, having that 12-step experience. And I'm not saying everybody I sponsor, but probably at least half of the people. Here's the progression that they go through. They've been suffering in Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to get a spiritual awakening with a fellowship experience. And they've had real mixed results with that. Somehow, either they relapse or they're half crazy, and they end up being pointed toward me because, You know, you don't go to Chris unless you're really in trouble because he makes you work with the steps. So they'll come to me, and I'll take them through the steps. And their first reaction is to get pissed. They're going to get pissed because why didn't somebody show me this before? Why didn't somebody tell me about this? And sometimes they'll even go back to the meetings and attack. And I've had people come up to me many times and say, one of your guys is causing trouble in our meeting, you know? What are you doing? And hopefully there's a maturing process that happens, and they'll get through that anger pretty quickly, because column number one will be those AA people that didn't tell me the right thing, or those lousy AA groups or whatever. That's going to be column number one. So hopefully if they continue to practice the steps, they'll get through that. They'll mature through that, and then they'll find that some meetings that are not, say, carrying a strong message are a fertile environment for finding prospects. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a good place to go for, you know, to find people to work with. I'm not saying I don't require very much of the people I sponsor, except that they need to go through the steps or they need to find somebody else. But I will strongly suggest that they continue to go to a broad spectrum of meetings, because another bad habit to get into is to just go to big book meetings where you just hear the answer. That's kind of selfish, mm-hmm. you know, to hide out in the choir. So I'll suggest that you have a mix of meetings, because, you know, we're supposed to be at a place where we're supposed to be of maximum benefit to others, not maximum comfort to ourselves. You know what I mean? There you go. If God is everything, then why is it that people tend to obsess over medication? Does it seem that people usually relapse because of it? God is everything, I believe. We got one of these up at the Wilson House, and I'm going to stand by what I said up there. This isn't really a topic that I can really share my experience on, because I don't have an experience on being on medication in recovery. So anything I would give you would be an opinion.
I've never been on medication either. But I know many people in AA who are and take it as prescribed. And there have been people who told them they're not sober because of that. And shame on them. Some of us need to go see doctors and get meds. But I have no experience about taking meds. I've sponsored a few guys over the years who were on medication, and one guy sprung it on me around a third step. Thanks a lot. But I want to know if they're on meds, what they're taking. And I'll have them write this out. See, they don't know that I don't know what the medication does, but they need to be accountable. So I'll ask them what they're on, how often they have to take it, what it's for, who their doctor is, what are the side effects, if any. So they're accountable to me, too, as their sponsor, so I know what they're doing. So we can have conversations about their meds. I don't want to get, if I'm working with a guy who's on medication, I don't want to hear he's been behaving in a certain way. Oh, by the way, I stopped taking my medication 3 months ago. You know, or I decided to double up on my medication. That I have a problem with. But taking it as prescribed, some of us need it.
Recreational medication is like another issue. I was working with this guy and got him up to amends, and he's out there. I mean, this was like one of those grueling, long four steps where it takes like multiple days. I mean, I put a lot of work into this. And we get up to the amends, and he's out there making amends, and the son bitch drinks on me. It was like, what? You know, you're in the middle of making a whole bunch of really strong amends. What is going on? I was really confused. Well, he shows up back at the meeting, and he starts talking with our friend Ray, Ray C. And Ray, you can't put anything past him. He's an old druggie from way back. And you know, he can just see your eyes and know, like, you know, how many milligrams you're on, you know. And he goes, are you on something? And the guy goes, well, yeah. And he goes, what? He goes, well, Xanax. Well, how many? Well, like 6 or 8 a day. I'm like, he was having a good time doing those amends, let me tell you. And again, I didn't know anything about it. It came as a surprise to me. So I've begun to ask that question before I do like a 13-hour fist step. Let's see what we got here.
It says, can you expand on meditation without name and how it has brought you to more freedom? You mean that, well, it was a practice I talked about that I was taught, the practice of no name has brought you to more freedom. The practice I was given to work with was to sit in a meditation without having my name attached to it. Not being Peter Marinelli. And when I first did that, my first few times working with that, it was uncomfortable, a little frightening at times. And I was able to see immediately my attachment to who I thought I was. With my name came a whole bunch of drama. With my name came all my fears, all my expectations, everything I thought who made me what I am. Peter Marinelli can do this. Peter Marinelli certainly can't do that. And that's how I went out. That was how I went out into all my affairs, with this label and attachment. And I would look for things to keep me filled up, whether it be drama or not. And I found that was incredibly limiting for me, because under my name came this huge attachment to who I thought I'd be, what someone calls a false sense of self. It was incredibly limiting, because what was behind that was all my belief systems, all my prejudices, and they would disguise themselves really well, so I couldn't recognize them, but they were there. They would just change seats on the Titanic. And I was told to go into this meditation and work with breath, but not see me with name attached to it, but truly a spirit, this spiritual being having this human experience. And I work with that. And little by slowly, I found out that, you know, what is in a name? I mean, I could be called a number or a color, for Christ's sake. It's just a label so people know how to reach me. So a name was pushed aside after some practice, and I got in touch with the spirit, who I be, from moment to moment to moment. And what started to dissolve, what started to fall away, was all the attachments that went with Peter Marinelli. All the limitations that went with my name, even my heritage that went with my name, where I was brought up that went with my name, all of it, it was all bondage. And I got to pay attention to spirit and breath and presence. That started to manifest in the rest of my day, leaving meditation, going to work, doing my chores, attending social events, doing a deal like this. I got past all of that. And I think I shared this a couple of weeks ago, that I've heard it for years in Alcoholics Anonymous, with spiritual beings having this human experience. To me, it sounded like a nice little AA soundbite, right? But it's given it new depth and weight for me, that I'm beyond name. And if you think about it, if the great reality is deep down within and we're spirit, we're beyond form. Ain't that great? God has me doing certain things, coming here, going there, speaking certain places, working with others, going to work, whatever it may be. That's how I show up. But spirit is the one taking me there, and what kind of spirit am I bringing there, if you will? Am I showing up to take the kids to Little League, or showing up to work, or showing up to cook dinner at my house with this attitude of, if you were me, you wouldn't be doing this, or you should be grateful I'm doing this, or am I doing as God would want me? That thing about being sensitive, that was able to dissolve my belief systems about this made me weak, was able to dissolve what a practice like this, because under Peter Marinelli Kane, well, I'm from Brooklyn. I come from this type of family. I was brought up this way. We're not sensitive. All this stuff into this block. No name, spirit. How would God want me to be? That also worked for another assignment that Bill had given me about what does it mean to be a man? My conception of a man. And I think I shared this early on. And I wrote down some things. And I sat quiet again and I wrote down some more things about what my idea of a man was. And that all came under Peter Marinelli's idea of what it is to be a man. My name, what is to be a man? And then I would judge good and bad, and I realized judging good and bad is how much of that is based on how I was brought up, my ideas of what is good and what is bad. And I work with no name. And I sit in silence. And everything I wrote on what I think it is to be a man, all the things that make what a man's supposed to be, not all of it was removed. I thought if you, a real man, made lots of money. So does that mean a man who doesn't make a lot of money is less than? Had to be married with so many kids and have a house. So that, does that mean the guy who doesn't do that is less than? And then don't I stand in judgment of someone else if I have more money than them, that they're less than? Oh my God. No name, spirit. And let me recognize through that, let me recognize the spirit in you. And not your ethnic background, not where you were born, not what AA meetings you go to. Let me just recognize the spirit in you, the great reality deep down with you, within you. That allows me to come right back to presence. Not trying to interpret the moment. Not trying to interpret. Not trying to figure out or judge. Just presence.
Why doesn't Barefoot Bill wear shoes? From Lena. No. I don't think there's going to be a comment. Here we go. Peter, Chris, are you guys for real? Now it says here, how did your concept of God evolve during years of recovery, working the steps and working with others? My concept of God in the beginning was pretty grim. I had a distorted Old Testament-ish type of punishing God in white robes up on a throne in heaven, ready to punish my ass the minute I get up there, you know, with probably 200,000 years of purgatory, and then send me to hell, just as a joke kind of conception of God. I only knew, you know, what I knew. And I think it wasn't the transmission of spiritual knowledge and spiritual concepts that was the problem. It was the receiver that was defective. I went to Sunday school as a Methodist. That's kind of safe and harmless, really. I mean, I don't remember them teaching me anything that was scary in Methodism. I had a family who were not overly religious, but certainly went to church. My father wrote a book on Basking Ridge Methodism that's still around somewhere. My brothers and sisters sang in the choir. The minister was down to the house. And I remember when I was a kid, I had a pretty nice conception of God. It was kind of warm and friendly and parental. It became twisted as my self-will started to manifest itself, because I was like a budding alcoholic, you know. I mean, self-will started to run riot before I even started with the drugs and the alcohol. As when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, the last thing in the world I wanted to hear was God was going to be my ultimate solution. That was not good news to me. And I was smart enough to understand the underlying concept of the steps when they were written up on the wall. They might call it your higher power, but I knew what it meant because it was capitalized. You know what I mean? So I know what they're saying there. And I had a lot of prejudice, a lot of preconceived negative ideas about spirituality and the God concept. I saw it as people that were weak might need that. But I'm okay. I'm strong enough to get by without that stuff. And I kind of fooled myself. But the fact of the matter is my quest for God went on throughout my whole existence. I really believe that the alcoholic or the drug addict, their underlying inherent problem is an unsatisfied search for God. I think that deep down in us, we have a need to be one with our Creator. And we'll use whiskey, we'll use sex, we'll use money, we'll use whatever we need to do to try to get that feeling of oneness. As I started to move through the steps, my experience with a loving Creator started to happen. And again, we speak so much up here about begging you, basically, to have your own experience with that so that you can, because it's not something that really can be discussed intellectually. God is not a theory. God is not really a noun. God is more of a verb. God is more of a power. God is more of an experience, than anything else. And to be able to be touched by that, I think, is the greatest thing in the world. I think it's the whole point of the 12-step program. I think it's what our recovery is made of. So rather than describe my specific experience with God, I'd rather encourage people to have their own. However you need to do that. Mm-hmm. Let's do another one here. In your opinion, why should a member be ready to sponsor another newcomer during and after completion of the 12 steps?
I don't understand the question.
Yeah. Could you repeat it?
When should a member?
Hi, I'm Henry. I'm an alcoholic. My question is, as a new member, just starting to go through the steps, when should, in your opinion, should a person be ready to start sponsoring other people while they're going through the steps or after they've completed the 12-step process?
Well, I'll save opinions because I don't like to give opinions, but I'll give you my experience with that stuff. And what I do with guys that I'm sponsoring, they need to get through to their amends before they're able to take someone on as a prospect. That changes from probably take a poll in here. Maybe people have different ways of doing it. But I like the line in our book says, we've entered the world of the spirit, and that comes as we've cleaned up the wreckage of our past. And at that point, I feel if I'm sponsoring someone, they can take someone else on.
One of the things I used to hear, part of the wrong information that was passed around in the fellowship when I first came in was, you had to have a year for everything. You had to have a year to get into a relationship. You had to have a year to be a treasurer. You had to have a year to start sponsoring people. I don't know what the big deal is on day 366. You know what I mean? That all of a sudden you're enlightened or something like that. You know what I mean? And I personally don't even know of anybody that waited to have a relationship for 365 days. We only say that to keep you humble because we know that you're going to fall short. But Somebody told me a relationship is the best thing in the world for somebody brand new. It'll send them flying into the steps because of horrible pain, you know. You never know. So anyway, the beginners meeting in Basking Ridge, which I've been frequenting for about 17 years now. One of the things that was suggested in the second I had a chance to rewrite the whole deal, I wrote it out of there, was that a sponsor should have a year. I think a sponsor should have an experience. A sponsor should have an experience. If they've experienced a part of a recovery process, they can share that. You know, the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. So, you know, the literature is giving us our parameters. There was two or three times in Alcoholics Anonymous where the membership exploded. One was the Jack Alexander article. There was maybe a couple of hundred AAs, you know, sprinkled around the country. And all of a sudden, Jack Alexander writes this article, Alcoholics and God. And all of a sudden, they went from 200 or 300 people to 15,000. They had people with 1 or 2 days sponsoring people through the steps, like 15 guys a day. I mean, it was just absolutely insane. And another thing, a lot of people like to get a sponsor with a gigantic, enormous amount of time. Well, my sponsor has 47 years. Well, my sponsor has 93 years. I mean, usually that just means your sponsor's like too old and slow to be able to get out of their own way. I'd rather, there's people that have just been through the work and that God is speaking out of their mouths. You know what I mean? I'd rather be involved with somebody like that, who the enthusiasm is just bursting out of them, than somebody that's, you know, kind of tired. So that's just me, though. What do you think? Not that we judge. How do you deal with justified resentment, i.e., abuse, neglect, things that come from growing up in an alcoholic home?
Okay. I can't justify any resentment. Let's get that out of the way. Grew up in my family with a dad who was a compulsive gambler. Would disappear for 3 days, 4 days at a time. Tell my mom and my brothers I'll be back in about 15 minutes. I'm going to go down to the corner. And that was Friday night. And Monday or Tuesday, he comes strolling in with a new Cadillac. And Wednesday, it was lost because of, you know, gambling. And I also had a mom who was one of us. And addicted to pills. And attempts at suicide, she finally succeeded and took her life. And we would march her in and out of every shrink in New York's office and every hospital in you know, the tri-state area, and with great hope that this was going to work, and only to come home from school and finding her, you know, drunk. So I grew up in this. And with that goes, and I've gotten to a place where I understand, and I forgave my parents, the way my dad's been kind enough to forgive me for some of the wreckage I caused in his life. But I've got to a place where I understand. But back then, in that type of environment, there were enormous amount of mixed messages. A lot of, you know, hope for tomorrow only to be slapped down. A lot of families I would watch, you know, look like the Norman Rockwell painting. In my eyes, God knows what was going on under their roof, because every family has their drama, some more severe than others. But I would see this Norman Rockwell kind of thing. I remember walking past a friend of mine's house, and his older brother was sitting on one of those Easy Boy recliners on the arm part, and his dad was sitting in the chair, and they had a German Shepherd sitting at the foot of them. And it lasted about 2 seconds. But I remember thinking, how come I can't have that? That looked like father and son, the dog, and everything just looked like Norman Rockwell, right? And I went home incredibly angry because my dad was a rough, tough character and gambling and working. And my mom was sick. And you felt very much growing up like you know, when's it going to happen? When's the ice going to break again? And anything that you felt hopeful about, you knew whether it wasn't, if it was under your own roof or out there, someone was going to pull it out from under you sooner or later. And that's a kind of an ugly way to grow up. And a lot of the character assassination of me, I got that a lot growing up. So it would be easy to kick back and sit in some shrink's office and say, the reason why I drank is because, you know, dad called me this. Mom was a drunk. I was touched by an older member when I was a little boy and in a very inappropriate way. And it'd be easy to say, well, this is why I am the way I am. For example, you get to the fourth column and all those things show up. I didn't do anything wrong was my plea, was my cry. I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't ask to grow up in this environment. I certainly didn't ask to have those incidents, those things happen to me as a young boy. How could my fourth column ask me where I'm at fault? How dare they? But what I found is this, that was one of the many, any lengths I had to get past. And I had to acquire, and it was by going to God in his time, a spirit of forgiveness and acceptance. Any kind of resentment that I'm walking around with, all it's simply doing is insist that I be right, keeping me angry and keeping me blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit, keeping me from experiencing the power of God, which, by the way, is the only solution for me to stay free of alcohol and alcoholism. So I'll stay really angry with you while I pick up a drink, but it wasn't worth it. So for me, there is no justified resentment. And over the last 18 years of being sober, trust me, there's been many times where I was incredibly angry about things and thought this was a good one. I can sink my teeth into this. I got AA this time. Because anyone else in AA would be really angry about this and nurse this anger. There were some things when I was working on the waterfront, which is kind of a rough environment and a lot of characters down there, some rough characters. And my dad was getting persecuted for something he didn't do. And the law was looking to put my dad away for a long time. And there was, I think I shared this a few weeks ago, one gentleman who my dad kind of brought in green and brought him up in the ranks, and he had a really nice position, was the loudest mouth chirping against my dad, and I says, well, I'm going to go look for this guy. This is justified. He's hurting my dad, so I'm going to do what any good son would do, is search this guy down, hunt him down, right? Like I was going to do something. But I knew deep down in here and by seeking with counsel that that kind of what I thought was a justified resentment, justified anger was futile. It was going to kill me. And so lots of inventory and a lot of seeking counsel and a ton of prayer. Father, please fill my heart with forgiveness. And I was going to pick up a friend of mine. We were on our way to a meeting. It was a Sunday night in Staten Island. And there was a guy jogging. And he looked vaguely familiar, and I thought he was one of us. I said, I know this guy from AA. And then I realized it was that guy. And God be my witness, I pulled over. I tried to come up with getting angry. I couldn't. I saw him from a different angle. I was given a new perceptions, if you will. And I'm so grateful that did happen because I don't know what would have happened if I would have gotten some of that anger going. I may have gotten drunk over that. And I would have not been of service to that guy who was family or to my family. So this business of resentment, our book says, is infinitely grave, not only to me, but anyone I come in contact with.
It says here, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Important warning sign. You know, from it stem all forms of spiritual disease. I am so prone to resentment. And there's been a couple of times in AA where I believed I had justified resentment. And there's some very, very loving friends that kind of were nudging me away from that belief system. What I really do is when I'm guilty of thinking, because it's an illusion that these resentments can be justified. That's an illusion, a misperception right there. But, you know, my ego will try to convince me that they just never should have done that. You know, and there's been a couple of times in AA where that's happened to me. And I held out as long as I could before I did the step work on the resentment. And that's my justification, I guess. I held out. But when I did the step work and when I made the amends, you know, I was okay. There was this one guy I was sponsoring. And he was a psychopath. I'm used to sponsoring psychopaths. It's not a big deal for me. But this guy was a violent, a career criminal psychopath. And you know, when I was taking exception to him doing things like, in a 1 week period of time, he arranged to sleep with three home group members of this home group I was with, and made sure that he told all of them that we've got to keep this quiet, you know, and did his deal. And then it all came out, and they found out, and was that, you know, and it made me really look bad. And then he borrowed money from some other sponsees of mine, like 30 grand for this business deal, and just completely ripped them off. And, you know, I'm starting to get angry, and I'm starting to not be a good sponsor. I'm not really effective anymore because my mind is a little bit clouded. And to top it all off, he fires me and gets my sponsor as a sponsor. And my sponsor likes him. Okay? That's as close to a justified resentment as you're going to get, you know? He's like taking him around and, you know. So I had to make amends. And my amends really were being an ineffective sponsor. I mean, some things happened early on where I just should have said, I can't think objectively anymore. You know, I got to get out of this. But again, my ego, I wanted to stay in and see if, you know, I'm going to make this guy get sober type of thing. And it was a nightmare. But again, I don't think there's any justified resentments. I think that's an illusion. There's no real justified resentments. There are only fatal ones. And we really need to be careful with these type of things. Should someone without experience with the steps be putting their hand out to the newcomer, i.e., should a newcomer be reaching out to other newcomers? I think should someone without experience with the steps be putting their hand out to the newcomer? There's really two things that you can do. You can carry the message to the alcoholic, which is if you've got a recovery experience, you can carry that recovery experience, or you can carry the alcoholic to the message. And certainly on day one, if you've got a car and the guy that came in next to you didn't, you know, you can reach your hand out to the alcoholic. But I don't think you can share something that you don't have.
I certainly think we should extend our hands, especially to new people. For me, it was like a Band-Aid on an open wound when I got here. I walk into a room of this many people scared to death, and someone was at the door saying, "Welcome." You know, pointing to the coffee, are you new? You had some sort of AA buddy, you know. They'd ask if you know where the meetings were. They'd circle some meetings for you. And like Chris said, some of them would direct you to speak to this person or that person if you wanted some sort of experience with the steps. And they were big enough to do that. By the way, some of the people who put in my path at the very beginning were big enough to know that they were just greeters at the door and we're just doing a contemporary deal. But if you want to talk about the book, go see Joe in the back. They were big enough to do that. And their egos weren't in the way where they said, "Well, I'll take you through the steps," and they told me, you know, do 90 and 90. So we should always extend our hand. I found safety in the numbers at the very beginning. You know, "Oh, Joe's going to beat. I know Joe from last week," and we talk a little bit, and I'd kind of mosey over to a seat and sit down, and I'd be okay for an hour. So, and those same people would, you know, invite me out to a diner, knowing I didn't have any money, but they didn't ever bring that up. They were gracious enough to just kind of keep that aside and invite me to a diner, and I have some of that camaraderie. Not everyone walks out of a nice 28-day cushy rehab, you know, in some nice neighborhood. Some of us walk in here right out of a hallway and need help and are scared to death. I hope I never forget the fear I had walking in here. I knew this was it, and I was still scared to death. So need to remember that.
You know, there's several people who saved my life early on, and I can't tell you that it was because of the steps. The first was a guy named Jorge in Morristown. I had just gotten done detoxing on the living room floor. It was the first time I could get out of the house, you know, without going into convulsions. I knew I needed to get back to AA. I had a car that didn't have a clutch, didn't have a heater cord, didn't have an emergency brake, didn't have a muffler. And so I had to go to a flat meeting because it didn't have a clutch. I found a flat meeting in the book. I get to that meeting. I go in and I sit down and I'm shattered. You know, like when you come right off of a week and a half long bender, I mean, you're just shattered. And I sit down and they're reading from the step book, and it's a 12-step meeting, and they're going down the row, and they're coming at me. You know, somebody hands me a book, and I mean, I've got it upside down. I can't focus. There's no way I'm going to be able to read, and I'm going to look bad. So I get up, and I leave, and I'm standing out on the stairs, and it was really one of those seconds and inches moments. I thought that I might not be able to make this AA thing. I might need to go home because this might be too much for me. And this guy, Jorge, walks outside, and I'm having a cigarette out on the stoop, ready to go for my car and, you know, drive the whole flat 7 miles back to my house. And he goes, well, what's your deal? And I said something like, relax, demons, hallucinations. And he goes, well, come on back into the meeting. Come on back into the meeting. And I'm like, well, there's a meeting tomorrow night. I think I'm going to go to this meeting tomorrow night. Is there in the street of my house? He goes, no, come on into the meeting. He knew what tomorrow meant to an alcoholic. Now, so he pulls me back in. He brings me up to the second row. And now they're done reading and people are sharing. You know how that goes. And so I'm sitting there and I'm trying to concentrate on what they're talking about. But, you know, my mind is racing. And he looks over me and he goes, raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back. And I go, well, there's a meeting tomorrow night. It's one of those meetings. They go around the room. You know, you have to raise. I'll tell everybody. He goes, raise your hand. He's starting to get loud now. And people are starting to look at me. You know, so that's kind of unnerving. So finally, just to shut him up, I raise my hand right in the middle of somebody sharing. Never seen this before. Never seen it since. They shut the person up that was talking, and they called on me because I guess they thought it was important. And I said something like, "It's because I'm alcoholic. I was running a relapse. There's demons and maggots and slim covers and little animals running through the house. Thank you." And there's this silence, and then they start going, "Yeah!" They're like cheering, "Yeah!" And as crazy as that sounds, I don't know if I could have gotten in and stayed into AA without that experience, because there was a huge wall of fear. I was just scared shitless of coming in and doing the AA stuff. And if I could raise my hand and tell you I was coming back, I might be able to continue to go to these meetings and I might be okay. Jorge had 13 days. He recognized that I was hurting and came out and had a cigarette with me. He had less than a month sober, this guy. The other guy that really helped me out was my first sponsor. Now, nobody, I think Howard might have been an exception, but nobody in North Jersey had step recovery experience when I first came in. I mean, you know, what we talk about in this group. And he got me active enough, got me involved enough, got me going to enough meetings so that I was able to stay sober long enough to be exposed to a recovery process that granted me freedom from alcohol, rather than just relief, rather than just abstinence. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have made it long enough to hear the recovery message. So, you know, those are two individuals that saved my life, and I don't know if either of them would have known a step if it bit him on the ass. They just were doing the AA deal. Ray, steps 8 and 9. Chris had said something to the effect that an amend isn't an apology. Isn't apologizing a big part of it? Also, how would you advise someone seeking to understand how they caused harm to another, unless it's obvious, when they can't find it, i.e. more subtle forms of harm? Well, this question is kind of to me, so why don't you answer it?
Say again?
That would make sense.
To the effect that amends isn't an apology.
Kind of multi-leveled.
Yeah, I went to the University of 86th Street. I don't know what IE means, so. Oh, is that what that means? Thank you. Okay. See, I'm teachable, man. It says, Chris, it's on. Okay. My own experience. I go make amends. To Chris, let's say I stole money from Chris. And I show up to Chris's door and I say, here's the $40 I stole. I'm clear on my harm. I sit with him and I ask him if there's anything you need to tell me. What can I do to make it right besides paying this $40? I sit and I listen if he has anything to tell me. And then I take that into the rest of my affairs where I don't steal anymore. And if Chris asked me to do something or maybe had to say something to me, I sit there and listen and be with that. And the spirit I take is I don't steal anymore from anyone. If I stole something, I replace the object or bring the money to replace the object. And I sit with these people. So if you want to call that a piece of an apology for what we have done, fine. However, my idea of an apology is, hey, Chris, I'm sorry I didn't pay you back the money, and then I keep going. Or I just give Chris his $40, sorry I didn't pay you when I was supposed to, and then it's done. And I never get to hear his side of it. I never get to ask him, what can I do to make it right? I never get to listen to the harm I've caused him. And I probably borrow money from someone else and not pay them back either. For me, and I speak for myself, the amends is going with God and apologies about self-serving to kind of get it out of the way so I can feel good again. But has there been a real change in behavior? To some degree, the amends kills the defect. I'm taking responsibility for what I have done. My defect of stealing, if you will. Every time I make amends, that power is dissolved some more. And I stand more in God's grace. The second part of this question says, how would you advise someone seeking to understand how they caused harm to another, unless it is obvious, when they can't find it, the more subtle forms of harm? Okay, maybe that goes back, if I'm understanding this correctly, is when I sit with someone, is there anything you need to tell me? And maybe at that point I could understand the harms I've caused them. A lot of times in contemporary AA we'll hear this, I've annoyed more people than I've harmed. And my challenge to that is go ask the people you think you've annoyed them or if you really harmed them. So if I'm not real clear in my sitting down with someone at an appointment to make a 9-step amends, maybe in our discussion I can find out exactly what went on, if I'm not clear, if I understood that question correctly. Make sense? Okay.
I think it's infinitely better in an amends to say that you're wrong than you're sorry. I don't know if anybody else was like me, but I said I'm sorry about a billion times. There was never anything that connected sorry to I'll do it different the next time. It's just I'm really sorry that you're really mad at me, and that's inconvenient for me that you're really that you feel that way, because I may not be able to get what I want now for a period of time, so I'm sorry. to be really in the spirit of an amends is to with humility say I was wrong when I did this, and I recognize that I was wrong. The amend really is the change. To amend a contract is to change the contract, change the verbiage in the contract. So an amend, hopefully, when you make an amends, you're not going to be doing what you made the amends for. That's not always the case. Sometimes our character defects hang on, and we have to go through multiple times of making amends for the same type of thing. But more often than not, going through this process really moves us away from some of the real serious harm that we cause to other people. What time is it? Wow, it's time. It is quarter after. I want to thank Bill for being a great guy and coming here with all of his equipment and his recording stuff. He will have. Thanks, Bill. He will have copies of this complete workshop. Please make arrangements with him if you want to do that. I want to personally thank Peter for being a part of this. I had a great time at the Wilson House with them. We had a blast, and this has been a lot of fun too. And I want to thank everybody here that's come. We have a nice way of closing.